Good morning, folks. It's time for Democratic Perspective, brought to you by the Verde Valley Independent Democrats, a weekly talk show about political issues facing the Verde Valley, Sedona, Northern Arizona, and the nation at large. Join us for a stimulating, thought-provoking discussion. You'll get the facts as we focus on the real challenges facing Arizonans. Good morning, folks. Steve Williamson here, sitting across from me.
He is. He's sitting here. Mike Cosentino walked in a little late. And we have Gary with us to keep us from fighting like we did last week.
Gary LeMaster. When you guys are wrong, I've got to say something.
It's going to be a good morning. So what do we have? We have inequality this morning?
Yeah. You know, last week we talked about, and Gary has another 15-page series of notes for us to read before we get here. We looked at Gillen's and Page.
I put them under my pillow is what I do, and then I hope to
absorb them by osmosis.
It's good for the recycling business.
Exactly.
And what Gillen's and Page was a massive new study, and what it showed was they examined 1,800 different issues, and they found that the wealthy, highly organized groups control pretty much the decisions made in American politics, which led Mike and I to terrible shock. I mean, we didn't know that.
Kidding. But, the rich rule the world, folks. You heard it here on KAZM first.
They found that we were indeed an oligarchy.
Yeah. Yeah, it's certainly heading that way. And,
or an oligarchy.
Oligarchy, whatever. Oligarchy, oligarchy.
I'm sorry. I'm the only one that thinks that's funny.
Gary, you want to read some of your stats. And see, the reason we suspect this is because the kind of stats that Gary has here, right, Gary, in the number of lobbyists, how many lobbyists are there?
The amount of money spent in lobbying, I think I mentioned this last week, is in 1998 was $1.45 billion was spent lobbying Congress. In 2013, that had more than doubled to $3.2 billion. There, in 98, there were 10,406 registered lobbyists in Washington. In 2013, there were 12,278. But that doesn't tell the real story. There's all sorts of ways around registering as a lobbyist.
There's thousands of unregistered lobbyists. Most of them are elected to Congress. I mean, in other words, I think our representatives are lobbyists.
What I think is more telling is that, The figures on what it cost to get elected in 2012 were just astounding. The total spent on federal elections was more than $6 billion. It cost more than $2.3 billion for the presidential race in 2012. And the average cost to win a U.S. congressional seat was $1.6 million. And the cost to win a U.S. Senate seat was $10.4 million.
So that's the political context, the economic political context of what we're talking about today. There's a new book out by Thomas Piketty. It's called Capital in the 21st Century. It is the bestseller on Amazon.
It is everywhere, all the time, on every financial show. It's amazing.
Bestseller on the New York Times. Now, this bestseller is about 700 pages long, and it's an economics book. And there was an interesting interview with Piketty, and they said, why is this French economics book so popular? And he said, it's not a French economic book. It's an economic book written in French because my French is better than my English.
Yeah.
So he's, I think, 42 years old. He's a young economist at the Paris School of Economics. And it is certainly the best-selling economics book in several generations.
It caught the publishers totally off guard. They, it's kind of an academic book. That's how they viewed it. And now they're so behind, they're out of stock, and they've committed to six more printings.
So if you're wondering what people are really debating and complaining about, it's Piketty's new book.
Talks about inequality.
It talks about inequality. Now,
a lot.
Income inequality.
But also wealth inequality. Wealth inequality and the impact of these on the economy of a country.
Everybody says it's not worth the price. We, you know, that everybody wants to find a solution to inequality, except those people who are, you know, the 1% and the who are getting the benefit of inequality.
So after World War II, there's this tremendous growth. It's much larger in Europe than it is in the United States. The growth rate's very high. There's a lot of shared prosperity. We talked about last year at its height, good American auto worker would make $50 an hour in today's money. That whole system of growth and that sharing of money is now gone. And a few decades after World War II, the theory was that, you know, if you've read really the old American novels about, you know, the robber barons and industrialization, if you've seen Deadwood, you can see how money works back then. The theory was, as capitalism starts, the income inequality is radical everywhere. The rich robber barons, the top, and then the poor are extremely poor, barely have enough to eat. But as capitalism develops and gets more complex, the theory was, the money gets shared more equally.
The middle class.
The middle class gets a bigger share, and it gets a bigger share because we're moving from this early, simple capitalism. Build a factory, don't worry about pollution, collect the money, and so forth and so on. So that's been the theory, and it was produced by a particular economist, and it had a whole lot of support in after World War II because people are really, really enthusiastic. I mean, the economy's going up, everybody's income, the poor is going up, the rich income is going up. And what the theory said was, you don't have to do anything. Mild distribution of wealth and income is going to take care of itself. It's going to level out. Everything is going to be just fine.
Keep in mind at that period, though, we had a top tax rate of 91%, or up to 91%.
Well, they understood. They understood that right now the reason why is inequality bad? Well, it's bad because it kills growth. When you can take capital, I think is what the whole point of the book was. Your capital will grow faster than anything else you can do. You can't make stuff. You can't do anything else with your money except let it grow. The capital can grow faster, and that's what's killing growth. That's what's killing jobs. That's not a good thing. The IMF, the International Monetary Fund, says, why is inequality bad? Why are all their members looking for a way out of inequality? It's because it's killing growth. And as soon as you say anything against capitalism, this is Piketty's problem here.
Piketty.
Is that...
It's Piketty, I think, in French.
Piketty.
We're going to Americanize his name.
Exactly. You know, as soon as you say anything, and he said that the Keynesian era will never be repeated, that this time you were describing after World War II is never going to come again.
So when there's high growth, the economy is booming. The difference between the rich and poor does get mitigated some. But when growth slows, and it's been slowed now for decades, since the 1980s, it's been slower. As the rate of growth slows, the rate of capital accumulation, the amount of money becoming wealth gets greater and greater. And, you know, he has a simple little algebraic formula for doing this. And it's R, which is return on your capital investment, is greater than the growth of the economy. When that occurs, wealth tends to accumulate more and more among a very, very few people. And what he says is right now, for instance, the United States is in a stage where most of the wealth that we see is accumulated by businessmen,
I happen to have a statistic on that.
All right.
So between 2009 and 2012, the richest 1% of Americans held 95% of all income growth in the United States.
And so what Piketty says is our picture of the wealthy is someone like Steve Jobs. He starts out on the periphery of the American economy in the garage, and he builds Apple Computer, pretty close to the largest corporation in the world. But Piketty says if you actually look at who has money, you'll find that if something like the Forbes 400 emphasizes people who have made money, it doesn't emphasize the wealth that's been hidden. And when I was a young man, I worked at Morgan Guarantee Trust, it was called in, and I worked in the trust department, and we handled the money of very, very wealthy people. And we have generations of people who have worked, barely work, or certainly don't depend on it for their income. So what Piketty does, it's interesting, he combines demography, demographics, with economics. And so you have to realize how different things are. So in 1780, the French population was 30 million. In 2010, it was 60 million. The American population around 1780 was probably less than 3 million, and it's now 300 million. It's because of immigration, the United States has grown just disproportionately. The French population has doubled. The American population was, Gary, is 100 times greater than it once was. When the Constitution is written, it's an agrarian economy with some mercantile guys, and but it doesn't have the wealth doesn't have the number of people. So if you go back to the Battle of Yorktown, this is where the Americans and the French finally defeat the British, right? Go to the Battle of Yorktown. Cornwallis is kind of trapped by both American and French soldiers on the ground. And then the French fleet shows up and blocks his resupply and escape. The reason the French have a fleet and the Americans don't, there's a lot of reason. The reason they've got a fleet and we don't is they have 30 million people and we have 3 million people. So he studies all these patterns in different countries. He studied the increase in population before the Industrial Revolution and since.
Steve, I'm fascinated by this history of loaning all this credibility to this gentleman's book.
That's
called
right.
Capital. But his solution just warms the cockles of a liberal's heart, because his solution is a progressive tax on the wealthy. Let me say it again. His solution to the inequality is very simply a progressive tax on the wealthy. That's the only way you're going to maintain Social Security, the only way you're going to maintain your pension, the only way you're going to maintain your health care is a nice progressive tax on the 1%.
Go ahead.
If you look at what caused this, first going back to the Revolution, I wanted to make a point is that a lot of the founders, particularly Jefferson, thought that the Constitution should be rewritten every generation. And instead, we viewed it as this sacred
document, yeah,
that,
for sure,
that never, ever can change. But so that's been part of the problem, is we're dealing with an understanding of the 1700s now in the 2000s. But the real problem of how we got to where we are is policy. Tax cuts. It's the globalization. Well, it's the invention of containers.
It's the system working.
U.S. is in a different position in France, right? France, there's a limited amount of land. There are already 30 million people living on it. The U.S., there are 3 million people, and there's a continent to exploit its resources. And there are millions and millions and millions of immigrants. And what you'll hear, there's a lot of anti-immigrant stuff now in the United States, but immigration is a huge fuel for the economy. They bring capital with them, some of them. They bring work, so forth and so on. And that's been a big fuel. So the United States is in a different position. So we have a little bit different ideology developing here. But what happens with Reagan coming into power, the economy begins to slow a bit, and Reagan and crew come in and they say, the reason it's slowing is there's too many regulations. These guys have a coal plant and they have to clean up their pollution. That's bad. And they say, if we just cut the rate, right, Gary, on the top percent, those are job creators and the economy will boom.
Well,
it
was based on trickle down economics is what you're talking about. And it was, it was the two advisors to Reagan that were the creators of it and the big proponents of it, Stockman and Bartlett, both now have fairly quickly after the Reagan administration have agreed that it was a big mistake.
Never worked, folks.
Never,
it was a
ever.
Nice idea. It could have worked, but it didn't work. There's a lot of nice ideas out there. I mean, even socialism was a nice idea. It didn't work. Not certainly as practiced.
And put in context with Piketty's book, about the accumulation of wealth, Reagan did some other things in that he cut the capital gains taxes mm-hmm. dramatically, and that's where the wealthy who have a lot of capital, that's where they make most of their money.
And there's tax advantages to someone like Romney. It came out in the campaign because he drew almost all of his money, but economists call rent from investments rather than from actually doing something. His period of doing something had ended, in fairness.
And one of the other big contributors to the income inequality is the kind of cutting of estate taxes, which in a brilliant move they called death taxes.
How did that happen, Mike? That they turned, because if you don't have taxes on these huge estates, and right now you have to leave an estate which shows $5,300,000 before you even get taxed. You only get taxed at 20%. You only get taxed on the money above it. So that's allowed the huge accumulation of wealth, right, Mike?
It happened because we had stopped. We assumed it was being taught in school and economics classes, and of course it wasn't. We had stopped making the connection between that growth was going to be damaged due to great inequality. On the surface, the whole death tax thing was your family built this, it made this money, you deserve to hand it down.
Family
to,
farmers.
You deserve to hand
away.
It down to your
I'm
children. And of course, it was a system, a free and open system, unlike any in the world, that allowed them to get so incredibly, terribly rich, and that system of our little republic democracy capitalist system that we have here allowed them to get terribly rich, and then they wanted the government to protect those riches. So once they took away, as Gary said, they took away that tax because it was such an easy PR job. Before that, they didn't try the public relations job to call it the death tax because they knew what it would do to the economy. The other thing I want to get in here is
but they said it was good for the economy, right? The less taxes on the rich,
we're Americans.
That's good for
we're Americans.
Economy.
What's collectively good doesn't matter. What's individually good, those families, those people were being robbed of their inheritance, and that was wrong. And so whatever the ramifications were for the larger economy didn't matter. We're about individuals here. We're about protecting individual rights. Get rid of the inheritance tax. Get rid of the death tax and allow those families and those extended and those anybody to accumulate that wealth because it's theirs, by golly.
So Piketty's book examines, I think, 20 different countries over where he can find the data 300 years. It's a massive working with data. He has more data than anybody had ever come. That's why it's 700 pages long.
That's why they can't argue with it. I mean, you'd think the Wall Street Journal would be having headlines about how wrong this guy is, and they're not because he did his work so well.
Well, and if you, if you want the easy way into this, folks, and I recommend, and I think Gary and Mike have their own recommended, I recommend the interview that Tom Ashbrook did on Point on NPR, and it's up on the internet. It's easy to find. It's called Thomas Piketty on Capitalism and Inequality. On the show, Tom Ashbrook has Romney's main economic advisor, guy who's chairman of the economics department at Harvard, on to answer Piketty. Listen to the program, folks, because the answer the guy gives are not much. The other thing is, I would just say, there's a lot of characterization of what Piketty says that it's just really not true, that he's a determinist, that he doesn't see the impact of education and the spread of information.
And there's the classic, if I don't agree with you, I'm going to call you a communist.
A Marxist. Yes, yeah,
yeah. He's a communist. Yeah. He's a Marxist.
Yeah.
He's French. That was the other
thing. Well, that's long right there. He loses.
And I'd point out, having French heritage, that we wouldn't have a country if it wasn't for the French.
Yeah, me too. You know, and we talked about Yorktown, but I mean, the French landed 5,000 guys in Rhode Island to support us during the American Revolution. What Piketty says is that when the growth rate is at its historical average or below, wealth accumulates vastly among a tiny percent of the population. That capitalism is not self-regulating. That everything is not going to work out all right, like the supply guy says. Everything's going to be just fine. Wait, everything, there's going to be a fairer and fairer distribution of the world, wealth. Everybody's going to be happy. Piketty brings massive information and massive data and a huge historical sweep to show this is not true. That wealth, the rate of wealth, the amount of money from investments is higher than the rate of growth of economies. What happens is that wealth begins to accumulate in fewer and fewer hands, and it multiplies very, very, very quickly. So, here's how it works. Suppose the economy grows at 1%, right? Americans think that's terrible. It grows at 1%. Then the next year, it grows at 1%. And so far, and all the way out. Then it's wherever you start, plus 1%. And then the next year, it's that figure, plus 1% more. And it accumulates surprisingly quickly. Whether we're talking about a population or economic growth, the rate of increase is extremely high. And reading Piketty's book is kind of an interesting experience. I mean, somebody called it magisterial. It is, he seems unattached to particular conclusions. You'll hear him say he does this and that. He has recommendations, but he doesn't try to do predictions beyond which he thinks his data could do. He can do educated guesses at the growth rate. So he's saying that the growth rate was high after World War II. It's now returning to historic levels. When it returns to historic levels, wealth and with it political power will accumulate more and more in a tiny percentage of the population.
Well, that's it. And that's the most disturbing part of this guy's book, Piketty's book, called Capital. And don't forget, Marx's book was called Das Kapital. So believe me, the similarities aren't lost on those people that want to criticize us. But one of the things that he says is that this isn't a mistake. This is policy. In other words, this is what the Occupy Wall Street and all the Occupy people have been telling us now for the last several years in this country. I mean, if there's anything close to any kind of protest movement, to any kind of counter movement in this country that gets precious little press, by the way, it certainly would be the Occupy movement. And what they have been saying is this, the inequality that Piketty talks about is not by accident. It is by policy. You just said it, that we thought that there was an even growth after World War II. What happened after World War II, that we had this middle class develop, was a natural phenomenon. He's saying it isn't natural. What's happening now
is an exception.
It's an exception.
What happened after World War II, whether you're in Europe where the growth rate is huge, or whether you're in the United States where it's slower, is an exception. It's not the rule. And what he says is, and what Mike is talking about, and put it, I'll put it in my words, is he's saying that although these economic processes are taking place, that wealth is accumulating among a few people, as Mike is saying, there are political things to do about this. It's not like determinism where we just have to obey. You can come up with good policies or bad policies. Policies that help with equality, help with economic development, or policies that don't. Now, you need some inequality, Piketty says, because if you don't have some inequality between the poor and the rich, you don't have the rich developing enough capital to invest in new things. So some equality, he says, is a good thing, but if it gets too extreme, if the top has just all the money that's coming from growth
right.
and all the wealth, and I don't know if Gary has figures on this, but that's what's happening. It's not the fact that, you know, it's not like too bad somebody has $1 million. It's like the accumulation of all of this money in a very few hands. It can go from being having some positive economic implication to being negative.
Well, it's because they don't need us. And people don't believe this. And this is why this is so hard to sell. That when you have capital can make money rather than growth making money, when your money can make money, you don't need us. You have this, and then this is the point of globalization. You don't need an American workforce. You don't need a Mexican workforce. You might need a workforce somewhere, but you can always go to that place. Provide those, you have plenty of capital, you can build all the plants and factories and things that you want, and you don't need, wherever the trouble is, you don't need it. You move on. So the Occupy Wall Street, if we can't blast them with fire hoses, we'll just ignore them and we'll move all of the income opportunities someplace else.
To be clear, Piketty isn't calling for socialism.
No,
it's not
very
clear. It's not complete equality. He's just trying to level the playing field between the very very wealthy and the poor. And you know the statistics, you know, that I'd point out is that the U.S. ranks number 2 for income and income inequality in the world. Think about that. I mean, we used to think of banana republics as, you know, being these grossly unequal, you know, societies, but we now rank number 2. We also there's also been this, well, we have the lowest of the advanced world. We have the lowest upward mobility. You know, the American dream was always the thing that anybody
right.
from any station in life could improve their situation through skills and education. What Piketty is saying is that capitalism left unfettered doesn't allow for upward mobility, that it offsets, capital will offset skills and education. So we keep talking about how we're going to improve education and everybody will develop these new skills for the 21st century. What he's saying is that unless you make some structural changes to the economy, like higher taxes on the very wealthy, and taxes on
wealth,
estates,
as well as income,
that it doesn't matter how much, you know, you educate yourself and how much you improve your skills, because capital will squash that.
But we won't believe that, and people won't. All you need is one kid on the on 60 Minutes or on the national news, like I saw last night, one little kid from New York that says, some, you know, ghetto kid says, I'm going to be an entrepreneur. And that's it. That's the American dream embodied there. It was on CBS or NBC or ABC or whatever it was. It was on the news. So the American dream is still happening. Now, it was some funded program by some billionaire that or some unusual government program that it hasn't been replicated and is happening in one school while millions of American kids are exactly like Gary said, by policy, kept out of the
those cases,
Harvard Business School for sure.
Those cases, those examples still happen. There are certainly lots of people that, you know, get to experience.
I said I wanted to. You didn't say
yeah,
you would.
There are.
But study after study after study shows that the American dream is no longer in the U.S. It's been moved to other nations. Most of Scandinavia and Europe have much greater upward mobility than the United States.
Oh, those socialist countries.
So the accumulation of wealth slows down social mobility. Now, what conservative economists say in public when they're in debates, and if you guys saw Romney thing where about the 47% and the 1% are good, is one thing. What they say when they're talking to other economists,
just to clarify,
is,
he said 47% of people are getting so much through social programs that they've lost what their ability to innovate and become
the reason there's so many social programs, of course, is because the amount of money that people can actually earn has gotten so low that people need support. You can have two people working on full-time jobs, certainly in Arizona, and they're eligible for food stamps because they're not making any money. Because there's another thing that would increase things is a high minimum wage. But when you hear the conservative economic folks talk, what they say are things like education and information exchange is the basis of wealth in the modern world. And if we increase that, it'll somehow solve all the problem, which it is good. Mike and I are always talking about, and Gary too, about the importance of education. But education produces wealth in a stronger way than other things. But when Romney's advisor argues with Piketty about this, he says, you know, the key to this is education, more education, better education and stuff. But, you know, you're 40 years old. You're not going to, going to be able to go back to college without blood, sweat and tears.
Well, you can't. And the news is full of now all these college graduates. It's coming up to graduation time. Condoleezza Rice, by the way, was banned from Rutgers. We want to have a round of applause for that. She won't be speaking.
She wasn't banned. She quit. There was controversy. So she declined to accept the $35,000 speaking fee.
Oh my gosh. That really hurt.
She's not going to be speaking at Rutgers. And taking the $35,000 speaking fee. So all's right with the world. But the idea is that so much of the inequality is planned. This is the system working the way it's supposed to work.
Okay, so Piketty does things like, why is the compensation, particularly looks at the U.S., of CEOs so high? Yeah, and we've all noticed this. The company is going bankrupt or losing money, and they double the CEO's salary from $100 million to $200
million.
And he takes it, of course. This doesn't even show his really full income a lot of time. And what Piketty says is that the rich are – there's no market here. The rich are setting their own salaries.
That's right.
The guys who run things are setting the rule. So you have the same – rate of economic growth in Sweden as the U.S. say, and their entrepreneurs, their CEOs make about a tenth of the amount that ours do. It's not really, in other words, super high CEO salaries are not being driven by the market, and they're not increasing economic productivity. If you look, one of the things that Piketty does, I think, because he is French, is he looks at a lot of different areas of the world.
The reason for the CEO salaries, in all honesty, I remember watching this in the late 70s and early 80s, is that somebody had the bright idea to tie CEO compensation to stock performance. Prior to that, the CEO was trying to improve the company. There were long-term plans. I used to get marketing plans business plans from clients that were 10-year plans. Then it got cut to 5. Then it got cut to 1. And the reason being is that everything was based on stock performance. So, a CEO started, changing and making decisions based on what the would happen with the stock price in order to bump up his own compensation. And so their compensation, stock prices, you can easily manipulate that if you're the CEO. Stock prices would jump up. He'd make a fortune off of it. And, then if it was going to have long-term consequences to the company, he'd just bail.
All right. And so there's kind of a circle here. The CEO largely selects the board of directors, and the board of directors decides the CEO's salary.
They all sit on each other's boards.
Yes, and then they all sit on each other's boards. So it's not really competition going on up at the top levels of income performance. So Piketty has solutions that people think are controversial. Some of the criticisms from the left, from some of the economists we've had on the show, like Galbraith and Tom Paley, criticize Piketty from the left or from a different perspective. But it's certainly important to raise the minimum wage because you can't get economic development. See, right now what's happened is we're in what is called a liquidity trap, where corporations are sitting on huge amounts of cash because there's nothing to invest it in. And there's nothing invested in because ordinary people don't have any money to buy stuff. Now, what disguises the fall of the relative standard of living is that everybody's standard of living in the United States, pretty much, except for the very poor, has gone up over the last 40 years. The other thing is that things like televisions, cell phones, what else, radios, all this stuff has gotten cheaper and cheaper and cheaper and cheaper. What's gone up are things that are a little bit harder to see, which is the cost of education and healthcare. So somebody said that toys are keeping people happy. In other words, the fact that we can go out and buy a new toy, a new electronic toy for much less. Remember what televisions cost 20 years ago?
We have lots and lots of people that can't afford food.
Yeah.
You know, it's. I just was looking at another study. You know, that's kind of what I do. Is you know, we have 30 million population in the United States. We have 50 million people living below the poverty line. We have 100.
And that bothers nobody.
And we have another 50 million. So 100 million total, another 50 million that are living on the brink, that don't know where their next meal is coming from. They don't know if they're going to be able to make rent.
And nobody gets angry.
They may be homeless. So you have a third of the population of the United States living at or near the poverty line.
The thing that Mike's talking about is this. The situation of the poor has been going down and down and down for all this time. What's happening, and the reason for the conflict, frankly, and let's be honest, is that the situation of the middle class, people like most of us, has been going down.
Exactly.
And once the middle class is no longer making the kind of money that they used to make, it's being hollowed out by the economy, then we get worried, because before we're just right.
Chris Hulme says meritocracy is dead. Meritocracy, in other words, no matter how smart you are, no matter how hard you work, middle class guy, it doesn't matter. Birth matters a lot more. You got to be the son or the daughter of a rich man or a rich person. Especially in Piketty's looking at 300 years of data. This guy went back and looked at all this tax data, which is why it's so hard to argue, which going back to what we started talking about, what the old American ideal is gone and dead. The meritocracy, that if you work hard and you keep your nose clean and you try hard and you get an education, you're going to come out of this okay. Gone. It matters. What Piketty says, what matters much, much more is which family you were born into.
But what he says is this is going to matter increasingly. In other words, it's going to matter more and more and more. When I lived in New York, I saw what the very rich could do for their kids.
That's right.
And if you wonder, you know, where to start, you know, tutors and preschool training I was talking to an investment banker one time, and my son played travel soccer, and his son played travel soccer. And I said, "Well, your son must really like travel soccer." And the fellow said to me, he said, "He has to."
That's right.
He has to.
Yeah.
He has to play soccer or football or something to get into college. And then he said to me, "What did he say? If you're late to the station, you miss the train." So you have to put your kids on this thing where they do all this phony charity work. I mean, if you ask the kids in the private school, they say, "I didn't really want to go to that Indian reservation. I wanted to go to the Hamptons and party all summer."
Yeah, right.
But Dad said I had to do it in order to get in. You know, what they're able to do is just absolutely amazing. It's misspent money, and it's also even correctly spent money, but. It is just getting worse and worse, and people don't see it. And Piketty's thing about wealth is you don't see wealth like you do see income.
Right.
So Forbes has the income of these guys are producing, but it doesn't show wealth. And when I worked at the bank, and I just had a glimpse of this, the wealth is so dispersed and so it's almost invisible the super wealthy's wealth is so scattered among different investments and different.
That's very important.
Yeah, we're painting a pretty bleak picture here, and I want to make the point that Piketty offers solutions, and that it can be changed. You know, we got in this mess because of policy decisions,
right?
And we can make policy decisions that will get us out of
exactly.
this mess.
Exactly what he says.
And what he's saying is calling for kind of a reinstitution of the estate tax, yeah. and 80% of tax on wealth, and he's talking about a 80% tax on incomes, after-tax incomes of $500,000 or more.
So you have a house. You have a house.
So there are solutions.
Yeah, there are solutions. He's very strong. You have a house.
We go back to the post-World War II era.
You have a house. The house is worth $300,000. Your mortgage is $280,000.
Oh,
you look
at
being taxed on the worth of your house now. What Piketty says is you should be taxed on your wealth. So if you only have $20,000 of wealth in your house, yeah. that's what you should pay a tax on. It's a very different way of looking at things. But Gary is absolutely right. He's not deterministic. He's not pessimistic. He's saying things can be solved by intelligent policies. And he's not really that ideological. He didn't support yeah. Hollande's increase of taxes on the very wealthy in France because he said, French institutions are so ossified and so corrupt, not in a taking money kind of sense, but just non-working, that's the big issue. The big issue, the big way to increase things in his country is a little bit different than the U.S.
Yeah, that's an important point that I'm sitting here sounding like a Bolshevik, you know, jumping up and down. But he doesn't. He's
wearing a bright red shirt.
Yeah, exactly.
Folks.
Yeah. Rational and educated and very factual and has all his ducks in a row. And it just confirms what other writers have said.
Too. That's what's infuriating to the people who disagree with him is that he's made his argument so soundly that nobody can find facts to tear it apart.
Well, they'll just wait for it to go away. You know, the United Gore Vidal called us the United States of Amnesia, the USA. We can't remember anything from one Newsweek to the next, even with a 24, especially maybe with a 24/7 news cycle. We have so much information thrown at us.
His book, Thomas Piketty, book is Capital in the 21st Century.
A year from now, you say who?
It has sent a shockwave through the entire economic community and people who follow public policy. It is new information, a new analysis, a very different point of view. The book is filled, and Mike won't let me go into it, of course, because our time is out, but it's filled with fascinating facts and figures and charts and graphs.
He has
a lot of new information that, and even not policy, just really interesting stuff.
Do we have some announcements to make?
But it won't help the Diamondbacks win a stinking game.
No.
Actually, they're on a roll. Oh. Four in a row.
That's right.
Do we have any announcements this week?
Not this week. Next week we'll have lots of announcements. We do want to thank.
I do want to say Gasland at the Sedona.
Yes, that's
library.
Right.
We want to talk about Gasland at the Sedona Library and
a free movie.
Yeah, a free movie. I don't have the flyer in.
And what they have, by the way, fracking companies have sent representatives to other Gasland showings. So maybe we'll have some controversy there. I'm scheduled to lead the discussion afterwards if anybody hangs around.
What's the date on it? Do you know?
That's a really good question. It's, please check your local listings.
check the Facebook or website of the Democrats of the Red Rocks. You'll find it there.
Yes, yeah. Democrats of the Red Rocks, Democrats of the Verde Valley contribute to us. Mike will be leading a discussion, Gasland 2.
Yep,
the
yep.
next month is an interesting field called Damnation, which is about the crazy building of dams all over the United States, which are now becoming obsolete. So there's some really good, and all these movies are free. Some of them are sponsored with other clubs.
Don't forget the website, vvid.org, vvid.org.
been listening to Democratic Perspective, brought to you by the Verde Valley Independent Democrats, a weekly talk show focusing on the political issues facing the Verde Valley, Sedona, Northern Arizona, and the nation at large. Catch us every Monday morning after the 8 o'clock news, right here on AM 780 KAZM. It's beautiful out there, folks. Have a great day.